This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 8th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, our Toronto Bureau Chief Nelly Gochiva gives us the lowdown on Canadian design and architecture when she pays a visit to IDEX, the industry's leading conference there.
If you have an opportunity like this, let's push it. Let's invent new technologies or at least take existing technologies and see how far we can push them.
Thomas Lewis joins the world's graphic design giants at the members-only annual RG Open conference in London.
The good work is really pushing boundaries and really challenging us. And so I think we're in a very, very good situation right here, right now.
And from the future of typefaces to the decades past of design, David Pleasant heads to East Sussex. There he visits the Ditchling Museum of Art and Craft, which houses some of the best pieces of 20th century design.
I see really what we bring from here is craftsmanship. And high-tech has craftsmanship, just as low-tech does. But the link is craftsmanship.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Bookending our autumn design show coverage these last couple of weeks, we open in Canada, where IDEX, the National Design and Architecture Fair, welcomed 15,000 interior designers, architects, building developers and business executives in Toronto. On show were 350 exhibitors with their latest products. Our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gochiva, paid them a visit. She had a chat with Evan Baer from the Bunkie Company about their mini cottage solution. But first, she stopped by the IDEX Wood Shop, a project by the City of Toronto that looks into innovative ways of using ash tree wood. One of the designers taking part in the project is Miles Keller with his lounge chair.
Toronto has a total of about 10 million trees. We're like a city of parks. Of those 10 million trees, about a million are ash trees. And there's an invasive species of bug that's a problem here as well as other cities called the emerald ash borer that is in the process of killing all 1 million ash trees. Not all at once, but it's a very slow process. But the problem is these trees have to come down. And up until now, most of these trees have been turned into wood chips. And so the city, I think in a very inspired, bold move, has decided to look for other avenues for all of this wood inventory. So one of the ideas was to create a competition where local craftsmen and designers would find other uses for ash.
And this is how the IDEX wood shop came up.
So this is the first year they've done it. As far as I know, they're going to do it again. The idea is to invite designers to enter designs for pieces of furniture. The only proviso being that they must be constructed from ash. When the prototypes are created or made, they must be using certified Toronto ash, which is a really neat idea because we've got this big stack of beautiful wood that's going to waste. So the idea of sort of repurposing all that wood into a whole other avenue of expression is fantastic.
So how many designers have taken part in the project so far?
In this competition, there were 10 invited designers and they left 5 spots open for an open competition for emerging designers.
And you are one of the designers on show here. Can you tell me more about your beautiful chair?
Yes, actually, the first step for us was, like a lot of designers, ash wasn't my favorite wood. It's, you know, I gravitate more towards walnut or cherry or even maple, beautiful grains. And so I had a lot of preconceptions about ash, mostly that I didn't like it. It's just sort of a bland wood with a sort of a strange grain. We thought, you know, as industrial designers, we did what we would do with any project, and the first step is research. So we did about a week's worth of research into the history of ash, everything from, say, 2,000 years ago to the First Nations in Canada, and what ash was used for over that period of time. And what we learned is, say, 2,000 years ago, it was one of the preferred woods. It was actually a one of the more revered woods. And it was used a lot in, say, spear shafts or weapons, a lot of weapons. But it was used because it's very resilient wood. It's very strong. It's actually a beautiful hardwood, but it also withstands shock and it can bend and twist. So more recently, in, say, Canada, it was used in snowshoes, hockey sticks, the rimming of canoes. And so we took all of this and we thought, well, let's do a piece that somehow reflects the potential that ash represents in terms of construction. And also, I think, let's play a little bit with the history of the sorts of things it's been used for in Canada. So when you look at our piece, immediately you see there's a bit of snowshoe in it, there's some hockey stick in it, and there's a bit of canoe in it. So it was blending all three in terms of the kinds of wood we use, the technology, the construction techniques, and the overall form. Ultimately, it was to give it some soul, and also, I think, some sex appeal.
And it's a beautiful product. So where do you see it, though? Like, do you see it in people's houses? What kind of person? Who is your consumer?
I think, you know, one of the things in Canada that's everyone who spends any time here, especially at a cottage up in Muskoka, knows about is there's something called the Muskoka chair. It's made out of wooden planks. And when we had this piece done, we thought, this looks like the next version of the Muskoka chair. So one place we see this is outside, like on a deck by your lake outside your cottage. The other was, it could easily go inside as well. It could be, and I think it looks, it's a chaise that looks, I think it's sort of in the tradition of Corbusch chaise, in the sense that it's got a lot of soul, it's got a lot of character, and it's a very expressive piece. So I think it can fit almost anywhere, inside, outside. The way we're building it right now, there's no two ways about it. It's expensive. It would probably be in the thousands because it's all handmade. But I like that too. And the way technology we chose to make it is very respectful of the ways that, say, snowshoes were made. So we're using steam-bent, solid sections of steam-bent wood, which is a very time-consuming process, but also gives a piece, I think, a lot more character and soul.
How long does it take to make one of these?
Well, this prototype, and since it was a prototype, there was a lot of trial and error in terms of, that's the other thing, as designers, given a problem like this, you can go an easy way, you go, let's use proven wood joinery, we can use proven, take the safe way and do, you know, proven technologies for construction, that sort of thing. But I'm much more of the point of view that if you have an opportunity like this, let's push it. Let's invent new technologies, or at least take existing technologies and see how far we can push them. So we did that, which slowed us down a lot. But in the end, we could build a chair like this. Well, it's still about a week, probably, to build a chair, which is certainly, it's not IKEA, that's for sure.
After checking out Miles Keller's beautifully executed and very comfortable chair, I'm heading to the stand of the Bunky Company. Founded by Nathan Buller, George Torres, and Evan Baer, the venture offers a multifunctional 100 square foot bunky, or a mini cottage-like space. You can put the bunky in your garden, backyard, or vacation home and use it as an additional guest room or workspace. And now one of the designers, Evan Baer, tells us all about it.
The Bunky is a collaboration between architectural firm Building Workshop and then my industrial design practice, 608 Design. So Nathan, who runs Building Workshop, and I got together about 3 years ago after doing the interior design show. So it was 2011. And we wanted to connect on a project where we could cross architecture with industrial design. And 2 years later, we started seriously working out the concept, and it was the Bunky. And then today, where we've actually materialized it and started selling it.
So tell me, what is the Bunky? Describe it for me and explain what it is.
Okay. So what the Bunky is the answer to outbuildings, second sleeping cottages for cottage country. So there's a big demand for outbuildings. And it seemed like a great size for me to work in, because I'm being a furniture designer, to apply everything that I design and build to that scale. We're working with no building permit, so it's under 107 square feet. So that also worked really well with single beds and having some additional functionality within the space.
So it is a portable, smaller version of a outdoor house, or how do you describe it? Like, what is the function? What is the purpose of it?
The purpose of it is to, well, first of all, have an outbuilding on your property without a permit. And it's unique because it's modular. Like, it's built around the same concept as knockdown furniture, like IKEA furniture. I don't like using the word IKEA, but it adds context to what it is. It's really easy to put together. It's 15 main parts that get bolted together. So if you had a cottage on an island, or if you have a small space, you can easily transport those parts and build them within 2 days, as well as being able to add a lot of additional functionality to the interior. So the main purpose is to put up a structure really quick, not have any building permits. And the way that we've developed it is we've put a Murphy bed in it. We've put detachable chairs, detachable tables, so we can get so much more functionality out of that space. So if you're gonna spend money, you're gonna buy something that's under 100 square feet, then we wanted to make it as most worthwhile as possible.
And it's a really small space, but also it's quite versatile, as you said. And it can actually exist in three modes: sleep, play, and open. Can you tell me more about those?
Sleep would be the Murphy bed downs, and it fills the whole space up. But the idea of being able to use it formally as a sleeping auxiliary building. So the play mode, when you bring the chair or the bed back up, you would have the table and chairs that detach from the wall. So if you're going to play cards, if you're going to stay up, enjoy some food, you would be able to do that as well. And then just having an open space. So when the bed is up and when the table and chairs are up, you can have this open space to collaborate with friends, or you could it could be used as an open studio for yoga or for art. So there's a lot of different ways it could be used.
Can you tell me more about the materials that you used?
It's really simple. We try to keep the recipe as minimal as possible, so it's a lot of plywood in it. And my background in furniture design and engineering use these techniques using CNC routers. So the rib cage or the structure of it is all made out of plywood. And then we also have plywood finished maple panels in the interior. And we also have plywood in the shelving units and in the Murphy beds. And we have them all the same material, so that has this connected look in the interior. We have two huge curtain walls, glass curtain walls, and on the exterior of it, we've cladded it in barn board to create a real juxtaposition between the interior, which is really clean and minimal, and the rugged exterior.
How long would it take to put one together? Let's say I want to buy one, I'm ordering it today, when would I have it in my backyard?
You could have it in your backyard anywhere between 3 to 4 months right now, based on how we're set up. As demand increases, we can bring on more manufacturing partners. It's essentially digital fab done with CNC. So if we were needing to have 3 or 4 built at one time, we could contract that out to another shop to cut parts. So we can expand or contract depending on the demand, which is great.
Toronto Bureau Chief Nelly Gocciva there. Graphic designers from across the world gathered in London last month for the RG London Open. Typographers, book designers and graphic artists from the music and film industries descended onto the city's Barbican Centre to gauge the temperature of graphic design today. ARGY, or the Alliance Graphique Internationale, was founded in 1954 as a forum for the world's leading graphic artists. Membership is by invitation only, and those who make up the organisation today work in all branches of graphic design, all over the world. Monocle's Thomas Lewis snagged an invitation to the event and headed down there to see what's on the agenda for the next year.
Paint me a picture. La, la, la. Paint me a picture. La, la. Paint me a picture of your all-time favourite.
And it sort of takes it takes time to filter into the likes of...
Here at the RG Open in London, graphic designers from across the spectrum have gathered to discuss the industry today. There are 2,000 young designers here who, on day two of the event, are posed a question by some of the veterans of graphic design. Do you read or can you draw?
I mean, the question was if I was going to hire someone and, you know, one of them can't draw and one of them doesn't read or doesn't like to read, well, you know, I wouldn't hire either of them, quite frankly.
Marian Banches is a graphic artist from Vancouver who specializes in typography.
I mean, as a life skill, obviously, reading is more important. Reading's very important, but I love people who can draw, and people who can draw really well astonish me.
But it's a question of imagination, the bread and butter of any graphic designer, that's at the root of the drawing versus reading debate, the panellists say. For Michael Dempsey, a veteran graphic designer for the British opera and film industries, it's a useful question, but perhaps an artificial one.
Graphic design is, there's no right way and there's no wrong way anymore. There's just a way, and you have to find the way that you like.
Dempsey was responsible for the redesign of London's English National Opera Company and designed the opening sequences for the movies of British film director David Hare.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
He says the approach for young designers entering the field today should be a fairly simple one.
I approach everything in the same way, in that I read, do a bit of research, and then just think. And a lot of my thinking often is done on the top of a bus. You know, it's the best place.
The speakers here at the two-day event represent most of the branches of graphic design. Typographers, poster and book designers, and creatives from the magazine and film industries are all here. Events like this one are designed to give those starting out in the industry a toehold in an increasingly shifting field. The digitization of the design industry has had two key effects on graphic design. These are different days to those of the Letraset typeface system, developed in the 1960s. Its bold, austere lettering forms a large part of the work of Andrew Stevens, of the Graphic Thought Facility, who worked on the graphic design of London's Olympic Park.
It's always been an important part of the makeup that got me into graphic design, and so I always had a strong affection for it and its iconography. In a way, having those boundaries to push against is always a great start for a designer, because you're within a set vocabulary, you've got to kind of react with it and use it as the tool to get somewhere else.
Digital design may have democratized the industry. Anyone, anywhere can now pretty much design something and share it online. But it's also, in many ways, saturated the design landscape. As Tony Brook, graphic designer and UK president of ARGI, tells me.
Well, there are always things to be concerned about. You're always driving to be better, but it's in fantastically rude health. I think it's actually a golden period. And I think that, personally, I think that computers have had a huge hand in that. That more work has been made, there's more bad work has been made, but there's also more good work, and the good work is really pushing boundaries and really challenging us. And so I think we're in a very, very good situation right here, right now.
Graphic design might be becoming a more competitive field, but those commissioning work are also getting more choosy. Marian Banches again.
7-8 years ago, I was really sticking out for doing something new. And then, you know, a lot of people started doing similar things. And I'm sort of constantly moving myself ahead. I'm constantly changing my work. Quite frankly, they don't have the awe for the work that they used to have. And so they're more difficult to please.
Everything from typeface to the design of book covers and LP sleeves are up for grabs here.
So how does jazz, typography and graphic design combine into this, you know, obsession? How many people, show hands, has today in their home a record, an LP, a vinyl record?
The mood here in London is upbeat, but there is a very quiet sense of nervousness here too.
To see 2,000 young designers is fantastic. My only worry is that because it is such a big industry and there are not enough spaces within that industry, what are they all going to end up doing? You know, I think having a creative education is great because they can take that anywhere, you know, end up in whatever sphere, and it'll be useful. Better than, you know, all those people sitting in the city pushing numbers around. I much prefer to hang out with creative people every time.
And those creatives have another, more pressing question to pose the 2,000 young designers here as the conference draws to a close.
One last question before we close. This is anonymous. How important are jazzy socks to the design process?
The industry might be filling up, but the advice is clear. Get a pen, a book, and a pair of jazzy socks, and you're ready to make your way in graphic design. Paint me a picture. For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis. Paint me a picture.
Thanks, Tom. Coming up after this short break, we'll be back in East Sussex visiting a museum that celebrates the not-too-distant past of British art and craft.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to the show. Now, from the debates and dialogues surrounding graphic design, we head into the world of 20th century art and craft. The Downs on England's south coast is the bucolic setting of the small village of Ditchling, which now hosts a much expanded new museum. The Ditchling Museum of Art and Craft is set to house one of the UK's most important collections of 20th century design. The project, which is housed in a former school in its neighbouring agricultural building, is also a wonderful piece of design in its own right. Monocle's David Pleasant got the Brighton train to this sleepy East Sussex spot to find out more.
Unless you have a pretty active interest in 20th century British typography and design, the name Ditchling would mean very little to you. This pretty little village, some 8 miles from Brighton, is in fact synonymous with what became a community of influential typographers, weavers, artists, and other craftsmen that changed the course of modern design. It all started when Eric Gill, later to become most known for the eponymous sans-serif font, moved to the village in 1907. Others followed, and in 1921, the Guild of St. Joseph and St. Dominic was founded. This Roman Catholic community, inspired by arts and crafts minimalism, had a distinctive spiritual purity. Now, the museum that houses many of the original designs and equipment has been reopened with carefully modernised features that evoke much of the founding principles of the members of the group. I'm going to walk across the village green to the museum's entrance.
My name's Adam Richards of Adam Richards Architects. We're the architects for the museum, and we were involved really from very early on in a sort of strategic approach to the site all the way down to the exhibition display. And we're now standing in the main gallery, which is in a converted Victorian school, which forms the sort of heart of the museum. But the project obviously encompassed some additional buildings as well. The key thing that we've done, I suppose, is making a gallery to display the Stanhope Press, which was used by Gill and other people at Ditchling to disseminate their ideas. They produced beautiful printed images and drawings, but also wrote social tracts. And so there was a sense in this sort of fairly remote then village, from this sort of kernel they were sending out broadcasts to the world. And so we thought it was really important to exhibit the press in a meaningful way. And so much of their concerns were to do with ethics and faith. And so the working title that we had when we were working on it in the office was The Sacred Workshop, because we thought that it really brought together so many of the themes that motivated them. So we've placed the press at the end of a gallery that is loosely based on a sort of Byzantine chapel. There's nothing literal about it. It just has a subtle cue of association. And the press is placed in the position that you might find the altar in a chapel. And it's still in use today, so workshop groups use the press. And so the idea is that when the press is in use, there'll be these mysterious figures performing what appears to be an arcane ritual at the end of the space. And that both brings to life the, I suppose, an association of the religious life of the people who are here, but also the world of making and of if you like, broadcasting their ideas to the world.
My name's Hilary Williams, and I'm the director of Ditchling Museum of Art and Craft.
So one of the first exhibits as we come into this space is a little explanation of the life of Eric Gill, a very famous name in terms of British design. Can you just tell us a little bit about the background for our international listeners, just where he fits into the story of British design?
Well, Gil was a letterer, a type designer, which is how many people may know him in terms of the fonts on their computers of Gil Sans or Joanna or Aries.
If we go back to a topic that I know maybe you're not that keen on covering, but it has been discussed with one of the trustees just now and it maybe has to be raised. Interestingly, within how Gil specifically fits into what was being mentioned as the canon of British artists and so on, for a particular reason, he's kind of late being kind of knocked off that canon and being kind of perhaps relegated and overlooked for particular reasons. I mean, can you again tell people who maybe don't know much about Gil what exactly the background to that controversy is?
I think if I just sort of refer everyone to a biography that was written by the eminent design historian Fiona McCarthy in 1989, when she revealed elements of his life that were perhaps not particularly pleasant by going through his diaries. I think as an organisation we accept that, you know, he was controversial during his life and now is controversial after his death. And while we don't necessarily condone the decisions that he personally arrived at, that actually he is an important artist. And if you don't want to engage with his work, there are a number of other artists within the collection who perhaps you will feel more comfortable to see. And obviously in the museum, you actually get to see the objects in the environment that they were made and in the landscape that inspired them.
Back on the village green, I meet someone who knows the workings and lifestyle of the Guild from the inside, as he was part of the group himself.
My name's Ewan Clayton. I'm a calligrapher. I was part of the Guild of Craftspeople who lived in Ditchling.
You were one of the last members of the Guild.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your involvement in the Guild and what kind of a history and a place or a kind of community it was.
Well, the really special thing was what it felt about work. It was feeling that, you know, it's very much about work-life balance. You need a really good work-life balance, but you also need your work to be fulfilling and something that you're in charge of making decisions about so you can follow your conscience, because it was to lead to really your complete fulfillment along with everything else. And so they lived in various ways that helped that. So they lived very simply. So you didn't have large overheads, so you didn't have lots of bills every month, and that meant you could decline work that you didn't want to do for various principles. You didn't have to just accept everything that came along.
And if we look kind of to the present and to the future, you as a practicing calligrapher and academic and teacher of the art, the craft, what can we take from the Guild's work, the 20th century's achievements, the traditions and style that was started or worked on here? Are you taking it forward? Do you see yourself as that kind of person?
Well, I also have worked as a consultant out for Xerox at Xerox Park, the place that developed the first personal computer, the first usable mouse, concept of Windows. And I see really what we bring from here is craftsmanship. And high-tech has craftsmanship, just as low-tech does. But the link is craftsmanship. It's a, you know, Steve Jobs knew that when he was designing things. It was his background from his adopted father as a craftsperson, and actually him learning calligraphy, that enabled him to craft these tools with really, not just as design as a bolt-on extra, but realizing it's part of the whole value the way that it relates to us as people is really important. It makes us want to use and communicate through these things. So it's craftsmanship, I think, that's the link.
Aesthetic and ethical integrity with designs and products that have stood the test of time and continue to have a visual impact on the face of Britain and the world beyond. To properly represent the life and work of the Guild at Ditchling has been challenging. The wrong sort of notoriety surrounding one of its members in particular, and the need to tell one story out of a very diverse collection, could have been obstacles. However, the simple, functional design of the new museum make a fitting and enchanting tribute to this important period of British design history. The Ditchling Museum of Art and Craft is now open and is a short train ride outside of London. For Monocle, in East Sussex, England, I'm David Pleasant.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. And now for our weekly nose around the studio of a designer, we go to Lisbon. Despite a recent slowdown, the Portuguese architecture scene is still renowned. This small country of 11 million manages to punch above its weight when it comes to exporting building and urban design. One practice that has had considerable success internationally is Aeris Mateus, which since starting in 1988 has gained a respected position for its careful approaches to form and function. Senior architect George Silva gave us a tour of the firm's studio, which lies on the Rua Silva Carvalho, north of Lisbon's historic centre.
The practice right now extends through two different spaces. One of them used to be a typography or a printing press. I don't know the exact word in English. And the other one where we are at right now used to be a shop. And the studio developed these two spaces and remodeled the space in order to provide the environment for the projects to be done and for everybody to work here. The way the studio is organized is in two open spaces. One of them is larger than the other, where everybody works together. And in this format, the possibility that we have, or the characteristic that we have, is that everybody can see what all the other ones are doing. In architecture, when projects are being developed in their very different stages of development, either from the beginning of the early concepts or the early definition of concepts up to the final construction information that it's produced, everybody can comment on the other people's work. Sometimes it's just a superficial comment that one can make on something that it's hanging on the wall, but at the same time those contributions are always taken into consideration for the developments of the project. And this is a format that I think that it's also very present on the work process. Everything, it's always normally exposed to everybody else. Either small models, large models, early drawings, sketches, or large tender plans where everybody can scrutinize the development of a project. So we were at the space that used to be a shop, and right now we're climbing half a dozen of stairs to go into the other space, which is in fact the largest space where most of the people work and where you have a lot more of different things being produced at the same time. There are a lot of people drawing in the computers, but there's also a section which is fundamental for the studio, which is the model production. The studio is based upon the production of models, and this means that every solution and a lot of hypotheses are tried every day with the resource to physical models. There are two kinds of models that we do here. One which is seen as an immediate tool for the development of the projects and that are done in styrofoam because they are extremely fast to do. And there are some others which are presentation models that involve a reasoning, considering more the eyes of the receiver than what we are trying to achieve in the middle of a project. Aside from a lot of tables and the normal screens from the computers, you can see models all over that have been done in different stages of the development of the projects and that are just hanging around because the project is still going on. Because one other thing that we tend to do is to every 3 weeks to throw away all the models that have become obsolete, that no longer are important for the development of projects.
George Silva giving Section D a tour of his studio in Lisbon's historic centre there. Coming up, we'll be back at London's Barbican to indulge our love of brutalist architecture. But first, Alexa Firmanich pays a visit to the design studio responsible for staging Anya Hindmarsh's lavish and lively fashion shows. When it comes to the British fashion industry, few names are bigger than Anya Hindmarsh. Launching her accessory brand at the age of 19, she has since been awarded an MBE and become an official UK trade ambassador. She's also made a name for herself for her quirky and wonderfully staged fashion shows. They've included in recent years everything from a magical Willy Wonka-esque sweet shop factory to fairground carousels and 50,000 toppling dominoes. But what goes on behind the scenes of a fashion show, behind the flying models and planetarium sculptures? Monocle's Alexa Firmanich went along to this fall's 2013 performance and met the team behind the show, London Silent Studios, a design, direction and music studio. There she met Nathan Prince, Liam Patton and Oliver Davies from the team.
Hello. Silent Studios has been going for about 8 years. I guess what makes us unique is that we have kind of two disciplines under one roof. So Liam heads up the music side of things, which includes original music composition and sound design, but all the way through to kind of generative audio and sound installations. And Oliver and myself run the kind of design and art direction department. And our work's really varied. We might be directing animators, or we may be doing high-speed shoots or slow-motion shoots, as was the case for this project. And yeah, I guess what makes us unique is that all happens in one studio. So one kind of discipline influences the other. A lot of the time, both kind of departments are working on the same project at the same time. So a project may be kind of led by music. I mean, this one is certainly, especially the atmosphere was completely musical at the beginning.
And I guess we kind of like, we don't go off and kind of work separately and then come together. But it's literally the whole way through, it's kind of collaborative, which we kind of really like, because we do, there is projects where the guys have gone off and done Kasabian Tour visuals, or we've gone off and done a computer game soundtrack, but almost like the best results always seem to be when we're working together, because it's almost like musically we're not trying to do everything, you know, we're kind of like trying to complement everything else, so it kind of works really well.
So I mean, what's the difference that goes into the design planning of, let's say, a fashion show for an esteemed designer like Anya Heidmarch and tour visuals for Kasabian, or making a Google video or a Burberry show?
Yeah. They are very different. But it probably boils down to the same approach, which is a kind of quite a strong design approach. So we don't necessarily have a house style, but certainly for someone like Anya, I mean, that was led by Stuart's creative treatment and the idea of weightlessness and the idea of flying models and, you know, planets. And then we came in on, I guess, a musical tip initially, but then obviously the content for the puffer spheres, be it planets or bags. But then it depends. We spent 4 years working with Burberry on their shows and events all over the world, and they have a big art direction department, so that's more executional. So it's not as conceptual, and it's not about the whole experience. It's slightly more executional there.
Maybe you could describe some of the visuals of the show for people who hadn't seen it. What did we see? What was maybe some of the musical score? We had flying bags, we had planets. It's a little bit unconventional for a fashion show.
I think it is definitely quite unconventional for a fashion show. And I think what we tried to achieve, and I think what we did achieve really well, I'm really proud of the team, is that we took people on a journey and we played with their expectations and we gave them surprises, which I think is a real pleasure for an audience, whether it's a fashion show or a theatre show. So the initial part of the show lulls people into a sense of security that they're watching a standard catwalk show, which in itself for Anya is a milestone, because this is her first show with live models, which is something that was an ambition of hers for some time. And the audience expectation of playfulness, comedy, that very British eccentric theatrical style, was slightly confounded at the beginning by a very clean, cool show to a beautifully restrained, very fashion but very stripped out soundtrack. And what we tried to do from there was take people on a journey into space. the collection for spring summer 14 obviously is called Out of This World, where Anya's working with new materials and creating bags, some of which are defined by their lightweight quality, which gave her this very strong instinct to explore weightlessness. So in truth, the core inspiration came directly from Anya, who had been exploring themes and using references as diverse as Barbarella and satellite images of deep space. It allows us to create shapes in space and fill an auditorium with product, so people get both a close-up view of it, but also they see large theatrical pictures, which was a big challenge. But it became quite clear that if we were ever going to really achieve a really close-up view of the product and explore a true weightlessness, then we had to work with video and experts like Nathan and his team at Silent Studio.
And in terms of the musical score, why did you decide on this? We heard some piano sounds. What did you come across?
I think it was like quite ambitious what we set out to do, because for this we went for 100% composition, original. But I guess the process started very much like a design process, so we kind of sourced reference tracks of to kind of set the tone, and there was almost like Stuart was kind of mentioning, there was different almost movements. So there was a kind of the upfront bit, which was more clean, kind of electro, to kind of give the full sense that it was just a straight catwalk show, and then it goes into this kind of spacey, orchestral, classical feel for the kind of remainder.
There must be a lot to coordinate, I mean, from the design to the models to the design of the bags, matching that with the colours, with the music palette. What do you think was maybe the greatest challenge? Would you be able to pin that down?
I think the greatest challenge was also the greatest success, and that was the synchronicity between the music and all the visual elements. Mm. And they are across three disciplines, as you say. There's obviously the video content, the digital visuals, the scenic visuals, and of course at the heart of it the collection. And really that was only possible by working with a company like Silent, because of this hand in glove approach to visuals and sound. I think we wouldn't have achieved such a harmonious and elegant and beautiful solution.
That was Monocle's Alexa Firmanich talking to Nathan Prince, Liam Patton, Oliver Davies from Silent Studios. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. 26 years ago, Bracken House was the first post-war building to be listed in Britain. With its rather traditional architectural style, the former home of the Financial Times, built in 1950, was a relatively uncontroversial choice. Yet that hasn't stopped the teams of tuts and titters that occur whenever post-war buildings are added to the list. Are they beautiful, brutal, and are they worth saving at all? The English Heritage Foundation is currently hosting a show in London that asks these questions. Monocle's Daphne Denis is also keen to find out and took a tour of some of the most iconic buildings in London from that period.
The skateboarders, the graffiti, and the omnipresent concrete by Waterloo Bridge are a familiar sight for tourists and Londoners alike. But the three massive buildings of the South Bank Centre, one of the main cultural hubs of the British capital, remain a divisive spectacle for passers-by.
It's just ugly. The design doesn't look good. Doesn't look nice at all.
It's good, and it's a good background for everything else on the river. It's different. It's okay, it's horrible and ugly to many people, but it does what it's supposed to do.
The centre, built in the 1960s, is a perfect example of post-war brutalist aesthetic, with its angular geometries and its use of different textures of concrete. Yet until now, the British Secretary of State has given reason to the detractors of the complex. Only one of its buildings, the Royal Festival Hall, is listed, despite calls from English Heritage, the organisation in charge of advising the government on the care of historic environment, to protect the venue. Henrietta Billings is from the 20th Century Society, a national campaigning group whose listing application for the centre was turned down in 2012.
This collection of three buildings is under pressure from expansion plans. In the 1960s, the architects involved in the designing of these buildings were very radical thinkers and at the forefront of kind of 1960s radical architecture. This is a built manifestation of some of their most exciting ideas, and that's another reason why we think it's very special and should be celebrated and acknowledged, and we think that listing would be a really good way to highlight the building.
Standing in one of the three outdoor sculpture courts of the Hayward Gallery, Billings points out the unique craftsmanship behind the walls that surround her.
What's probably most striking about this view is the different types of concrete that you can see on one wall. There's a really beautiful contrast here between the precast panels with a very rough aggregate. And then above, from a distance, they look like they could be panels of wood, but actually it's in situ board mark concrete with the ingrain of the wood showing through on the concrete.
Yet concrete and steel are largely guilty of giving a bad reputation to post-war architecture. Many consider that buildings from the 60s and 70s are all made of cement and cheap materials, all resources that were necessary in a country ravaged by World War II, but couldn't possibly resist the test of time. Of course, that's inaccurate. Light and bright colours are largely featured in some forms of post-war architecture, but could grey aggregate and uncluttered shapes be beautiful too? Well, that's in part what English Heritage wants to prove with an exhibition on listed post-war edifices.
Post-war listing for us is probably one of the most controversial and high-profile things we do because, as you say, some people love it, some people hate it. And we wanted the exhibition to really encourage debate about just that, to have people come and have a look, maybe change their view about certain things by looking at the photographs and the models and an understanding the real beauty of some of the very best of the architecture from this period.
Emily G is the head of designation at English Heritage. She says this controversy has been around since 1987, when the law was altered to allow buildings of over 30 years to be listed. Still, protecting modern structures isn't done lightly.
Not every building from this period is wonderful by any means, and we really only look at the very top level, the highest echelon of design from this period can be protected. Well, probably one of the most recent sort of controversial cases which didn't get listed is the Robin Hood Gardens estate in East London. And that was designed by Peter and Alison Smithson. And there was a big campaign, on both sides of that argument, whether or not it should be listed or not. And it was mostly architects who were in favour of listing because they'd grown up with the Smithsons and obviously, you know, quite rightly respected their importance in the design canon. However, we looked very carefully at the building and felt that it wasn't fit for purpose. It was quite late in the tradition of that type of what was called streets in the sky, public housing, and we didn't feel that it actually fulfilled its design brief.
Just metres from the shunned Robin Hood Gardens sits the Balfron Tower, a 27-storey housing block with a separate lift shaft tower joined to the main edifice by seven narrow walkways. Designed by brutalist architect Erno Goldfinger, the dark concrete building remains a controversial example of post-war listing. Simon Terrell, an artist, moved in to create a photo project around the tower and decided to stay.
I wouldn't use the word beautiful, but I'd certainly use the word of fascinating and compelling and in its own very particular way quite wonderful. When I first got here, I found it. In a way, it was kind of terrifying because it's this sort of giant cliff face of concrete that you approach the front door to enter. But in a way, it works in that sort of classical structure of, you know, say a medieval cathedral will have its gargoyles on the outside but then welcome you inside.
Arguably, one of the reasons why the tower fails to impress those who aren't familiar with Goldfinger's work is that the building hasn't been correctly maintained. Signs at the entrance door and near the elevator warn visitors against possible doorbell or lift failures. The walls are dirty, and so are the windows. It is, after all, a public housing estate. But while the Robin Hood Gardens is set to be demolished, the Balfron Tower, thanks to its listed status, is about to go into renovation. And for Henrietta Billings from the 20th Century Society, that may be the key to reconcile Britain with its more recent architectural history. Showing the powerful lines of the Barbican Towers on the complex central entrance, she explains why that building has been a success.
It's extremely well managed and well maintained. And one of the things that we often find with buildings of this period, if they're not maintained to sufficient standards, very quickly, not only do they stop working as houses or public facilities or whatever, but also the perception of them is also affected because, you know, the concrete starts staining, they start looking uncared for and unloved, and that's what begins to give buildings like this a bad reputation.
And looking up at the horizontal lines of the estate's balconies, the contrast of the rough concrete, the red tiles and the fountains by the Barbican Centre, it's difficult to disagree. Brutal can indeed be beautiful too. For Monocle, in London, I'm Daphne Duny.
That's all we've got time for on this week's edition of Section D with me, Tom Morris. Next week, we'll be heading across the Atlantic to Brazil for a special edition looking at the past and the future of the design industry there. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer, Aled, at awj@monocle.com if you have any thoughts or suggestions for the show. I'm Tom Morris. And finally, a song for you before we leave. A nod to the era of New Look post-war London with this minimalist-inspired piece by Moby. This is God moving over the face of the waters. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.